Hello, and welcome to Spartan Speak, a podcast from the Lansing State Journal and Detroit Free Press, focused on Michigan State sports. I'm Phil Friend, your host and sports writer for the LSJ, joined by Free beat writer Chris Solari and LSJ sports columnist Graham Couch. Gentlemen, first off, I want to say congratulations that you might have been one of the only few people who did not get yelled at by Mel Tucker either Saturday or today.
I didn't think it was as yelly as other people did. I don't know where that's coming from. I mean, he was animated. He got a little animated today, got really animated Saturday. And I thought that was big for just the sense that we have not seen him angry at his team until now. Because the Rutgers game, I mean, there was a surprising calm. It was the turnovers. It was the start. He wasn't disappointed, I don't think, in their effort. He was maybe not as pleased in their execution. But this was different.
Yeah, I think partly because what you saw against Michigan – set a new bar, right? You had the struggles against Rutgers, but you also showed positives of moving the ball, of kind of settling in after those first couple possessions and really playing good defense. You didn't see that against Iowa. And basically, on Tuesday, Mel Tucker, after watching the film, called out pretty much everybody on the team, offense, defense, special teams. When a coach says that we didn't see anybody who played at a high level, well, that's a problem, and that's an effort issue. And he also made sure to put the coaches in on that as well because, you know, listen, you put the bar out there now that you can go and beat a quality opponent on the road at Michigan, and then you came back and had that letdown against Iowa. So I think that inconsistency that Tucker saw from week two to week three was more of the issue maybe than and the regression like we talked about on Saturday, Graham. That to me was the big issue and frustration with him.
We will come back. Oh, go ahead, Graham.
Oh, go ahead, Phil. Sorry.
I was just gonna say we will come back to all that later in the podcast. Today's topics for us, we're gonna talk about the news yesterday about Tom Izzo revealing that he has tested positive for COVID-19. Nat basketball signing day is tomorrow, and we'll talk a little bit about Michigan State's recruits. And Michigan State football has also been very busy on the recruiting front. They've had four commits over the past 48 hours, including three in the past 24. So we'll talk about those guys a little bit. Then we will get into everything Mel Tucker, Michigan State, Iowa game last Saturday, and then the upcoming game in Indiana versus Indiana. And then, as always, we will end with our predictions for the MSU-Indiana game on Saturday. Well, first, let's start with the shocking news yesterday that was revealed a little bit after 3 o'clock on Monday afternoon. We are recording on Tuesday afternoon. It was revealed Monday afternoon that Tom Izzo has tested positive for COVID-19. Tom was very upfront about how he felt he had taken all the precautions necessary to make sure he did not contract COVID-19, and then he still got it here anyway. So he's asking a lot of questions, and I thought his comments were very pointed. Chris, what was kind of your interpretation or reaction to the news yesterday?
Yeah, it shows that really you can take all the precautions you want. And I know a lot of people keep saying, well, masks don't prevent anything. And I think that's kind of been out there. I mean, it's not necessarily about preventing yourself from getting it, but it's about trying to minimize the risk for others. So when people don't wear masks, that puts everybody else at risk. That's the thing. And Izzo took the precautions, and he's been out front about that since April. I mean, with the state, with Governor Whitmer's initiative to get more people wearing masks, a lot of that came, I think, having the initial issues with Dwayne Stevens' father passing away after contracting COVID. I mean, that became a real thing. It became a very significant concern for Izzo and for his program. And, you know, now, I mean, this is one of the more, I'd say, at least within the state, you know, you're talking about probably the most prominent name to have contracted COVID. So, you know, he seemed like he was in good shape and in good spirits. He was still cracking jokes. But, you know, the frustration was there. And, you know, as a coach, and Graham, you can kind of attest to this, you know, one of the things that coaches are all about, and I think we all know this, they're control freaks. They like to control the environment, control the response, all of those things that come with directing a program. And what this showed to me is this is uncontrollable for a coach. And the frustration of him constantly saying, don't know how I would have got it. I'm banging my head against the wall trying to figure it out, but I probably will never figure it out. To me, was the most telling response there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't think anything's surprising at this point. I mean, it's pretty prevalent. Case or positivity rates are rising in most states, including our own. And, you know, I think this was, to me, a sign of what's going to be a very difficult college basketball season, because I think this won't be the – I'm not saying for Michigan State. I'm just saying for teams in general. I think, you know, look at what they do in football, and it'll be interesting to see what the protocols are. But if you look at the rate that shut down a team and the length of time a player has to sit out and the size of rosters in basketball, you know, you lose, you're out 21 days too. I'll be very curious to see how this season goes. I think, you know, for Izzo, you hope he's all right and that this stays mild and he gets through it fine. You know, and if he does, I don't think it'll affect this team a ton. But it is, he did say the right things, and I think he's an important messenger in what's a somewhat divisive subject. I can't just divide, like, I didn't write off it yesterday because I was talking to my sister about this, and I'm like, I'm not going to write for the people on Twitter, the angry minority, because it is an angry minority that are the anti-maskers and the saying, see, I mean, there were people on there saying, see, I thought he was pro-mask. How did this happen?
I will say this, though. I mean, I think part of it is that it is such a moving target in some ways. I mean, because, I mean, listen, we've got a virus that epidemiologists and infectious disease experts are still studying in real time. And a lot of information changes fast based on research and based on data that you find. You know, remember, it was March and April where people were saying, don't wear masks, it doesn't do anything. And then all of a sudden, the research and data showed, well, yes, it actually does prevent it, not necessarily from contracting it, but from spreading. You know, I think that's the hard thing to wrap their heads around.
And no, they shouldn't be. That was in March and April, and it was explained to them. It's people who don't want to accept that. That's been, we're not, this isn't like something new months ago. And yeah, it's unfortunate what was said at that point, you know, because we're not nuanced enough as a public to adjust as epidemiologists adjust and as research adjust. But at this point, there is no debate on masks. You can bang your head against the wall and insist a certain way, and you don't want to live in the truth, and that's fine. But what I think what that's why it's important for people like Izzo to sound the way he did and to say, you know, to say what he said, and because the messaging matters, and people get, you know, most of the people who cry about this stuff or think it's all bunk, you know, when you ask for research, they'll give you research that comes from a source that's pretty questionable. And I understand there is some debate, but anyway, I thought that was important from Izzo yesterday, because here's a guy who has the ear of a lot of people, and I think he, at least from his messaging standpoint, said the right things. I have no idea how he got it or actually how careful he truly was. And he said he was really careful, and I have no reason to doubt him on that. So, but I thought the way he handled yesterday was good.
Well, let's move away from that into something a little more positive when it comes to Michigan State basketball, and that is recruiting. Tomorrow, which is Wednesday, is National Signing Day for basketball, and Michigan State is expected to ink three recruits, Jaden Akins, Max Christie, and Pierre Brooks. All of those guys are four stars or higher, and really, and those guys really should fill some important spots for the Spartans for next season. Out of those three, Graham, which excites you the most?
Yeah, I think from just people I've talked to, it's Max Christie. I think he is somebody who they're really high on, that people I've spoken to in Illinois believe will be a really big difference maker for them. And so that's the guy that I think, like there are reasons to like all of them. And I think Pierre Brooks is underrated. I really do. But Christie's the guy that I think is a real, real, real big difference maker.
Yeah, all three of these guys are guys that can play with the ball in their hands, which I think is big. I mean, when you're talking about trying to find that next point guard, I think Akins is the guy that'll probably be the guy to take over at that spot. That way you'll be able to move Rocket Watts. If he doesn't have a huge year and turn pro, it'll be able to move him back off the ball and do some different things there. But the big thing about this class right now, to me, isn't necessarily so much, even though they have a five-star kid who's one of the best players in the country in Max Christie, you know, it's what we're not seeing right now. And it's what's going to happen with Enoch Buyoke and more importantly, with Imani Bates. Are they going to reclassify into this group? Because now all of a sudden, what you'd see is a very, very good Izzo class that will be up there among the national leaders with just these three guys, all of a sudden turning into maybe one of the best recruiting classes in college basketball history. That certainly is out there, and, you know, I don't know when we'll figure that out. I mean, they'll have to go through their junior seasons in high school, and obviously Imani Bates is starting up on Thursday with an exhibition game. It's going to be a broadcast, I think, on ESPN2. But IFC Prep is going to have a scrimmage, and that's going to be – it's going to bear watching what those two guys in particular are doing, because that's what takes this class from great to elite.
Yeah, for me, I think Jaden Akins is the guy I'm most excited about, and I'm also excited to see him team up with Bates at IFC Prep. Now, maybe the circumstances where they leave their high schools to participate in this new, you know, academy slash glorified AU team and be a little shaky, but to see those guys on the court together, I'm very excited to see this week.
And that's huge. I mean, that's if you are able to get Bates to reclassify and somehow get him on campus if he doesn't turn pro, because obviously there's a lot of outside factors with the NBA and are they going to change the age range and whatnot. But if he does happen to reclassify and come to Michigan State for a year, now you've got a year already under his belt established with a point guard. So it will be interesting to see not just on Thursday how Bates is, but how he and Akins team together and where their court sense is, and if that becomes a driving factor to putting Imani Bates in green and white for sure.
Well, let's stay in the recruiting realm and switch sports to football. Over the past 48 hours, we've seen Michigan State land four commits. The big one came yesterday afternoon when four-star defensive line Rayshon Benny out of Oak Park gave his verbal commitment. The Spartans beat out Michigan for him. And then they've also secured the commitments from JUCO offensive lineman Brandon Baldwin for the 2021 class. He is from Detroit. On Sunday night, very late Sunday night, it was Georgia offensive lineman Christian Phillips in the 2022 class that committed. And then right before we started recording, Stephon Johnson, a cornerback from Florida, who's also the teammate of another 2021 commit, Charles Brantley. Michael Brantley. What's his name, Chris?
Charles Brantley.
Charles Brantley. I had it right the first time. I got myself crossed up there. He committed to the Michigan State class as well. So, Chris, out of these guys, obviously Benny is the guy that highlights it, but you got that, and you got two big linemen in this group as well. So it clearly seems like Mel Tucker and the Spartan staff has really upgraded on what they're trying to do recruiting-wise.
Yeah, what a crazy hour that was on Monday, where you had Rayshon Benny's commitment, then you get Tom Izzo's news, then you get the Brandon Baldwin commitment all within an hour. That was certainly interesting times and timing, but
yes,
I think Benny is a big get for them for a lot of reasons. One, he had some significant interest from Michigan, and you know, the things that he said about seeing the difference in the coaching staff and their approach to recruiting and how they're selling the program was what allowed him to buy into what Mel Tucker was selling. And I don't know how much that's an indictment on Mark Antonio's staff, but it certainly for Mel Tucker is a big promotion, especially when you're talking about trying to lure and land these in-state kids. I mean, there's been talk about Andrell Anthony from East Lansing High, maybe revisiting his commitment to Michigan and flipping to Michigan State. And I know Michigan State's working on that. Whether that happens remains to be seen, but the fact that you get a four-star kid from in-state in Detroit, in the Detroit area, that's huge. I mean, cause that's where Michigan State struggled the past 4 years, really, in their recruiting. They lost Detroit after the Curtis Blackwell situation. The players that they were struggling to get, were going out of state, you know, the KJ Hamlers of the world or the guys that went to Kentucky. You know, they've lost a lot of those kids to more programs outside of the Big Ten footprint, but still within the upper Midwest region. So I think this is a massive get. This is a kid who can play both sides of the ball and play with ferocity, either on the offensive line or defensive line. He wants to be a defensive tackle, and he thinks he can start right away and make a significant impact. And look, I mean, they're going to lose Naquan Jones next year. You know, depending on how some of these younger guys, if a guy like Deshaun Mallory continues to show, and you might be able to think maybe he's a guy that could take that next step out. But you know, for what they want to build, you're seeing the Mel Tucker footprint now. That's a big one on the defensive side in the trenches. The other guys, in particular, the Baldwin commitment, they're thin right now at offensive tackle. And you go and get a guy who can come in right away, who is an older kid, who's a JUCO transfer, to play immediately. That's a big get on the edge.
Mel Tucker is putting his money where his mouth is, and you know if you can read between the lines on some of his comments, he's clearly, you know, not satisfied with some of the talent on the roster, maybe in certain areas. And you look at Baldwin, the guy from Detroit. He is 6'7", 315, I believe. And Christian Phillips, the Georgia offensive line, I believe, comes in at 330 pounds. So, you know, he's talked about upgrading the size on the offensive line, and he's, you know, putting it into practice.
There's only a certain amount of times you can go guards at tackle, right, Graham?
Yeah, no, they've been doing it for a while, and that's been hurting them. And I agree with everything Chris said. I think symbolically, it's the biggest recruit since L.J. Scott. And, you know, and obviously L.J. was part of, you know, what turned into the demise of the program and didn't carry on. But at the time, the trajectory they were on recruiting, when he was the first Ohio kid that Ohio State wanted that Michigan State got, that was a big deal. And I think in terms of, you know, when you look at the Kentuckys of the world and places where, you know, Rashawn Penny, Cincinnati's, those places that they were losing kids to, And you know, they've got to win those kids. They've got to win some of the Michigan battles. If you lose a receiver to Penn State, you got to own your share of Michigan. And I think there's a real opportunity that win over Michigan. I think things get overstated too much with one game like that versus relationships usually. But it does change the way people feel not only about Michigan State and what could happen, but if they were looking for a reason to believe in Mel Tucker, but it changes the way people feel about Michigan. And the conversation that's going on there, I think, is just as significant when you're talking about in-state kids.
It'll be interesting to see if Anthony actually flips or not. So when he committed, I think he was like the fifth or sixth receiver in the class alone to commit. And to me, that made little sense in terms of him and the rest of the squad. But I think a couple of those other receivers have decommitted now since then. So I don't know if that will influence Anthony to keep his Michigan commit or if he can be convinced to stay home here in East Lansing.
Well, what's interesting with Michigan State's 2021 class, notice what's missing, a receiver, and let alone a top-end receiver, a four-star type kid like that. I mean, he's probably borderline three-star, four-star kid, but you're talking about across the street. I mean, they've got his high school teammate Ethan Boyd lined up, and that's, you know, I mean, that, yeah, Graham, you grew up around here, and the Randy Kinder effect of losing a guy from across the street in East Lansing always has an impact on Michigan State. Even the Brandon Johns situation, though, it was a lot different, I think, because Michigan State had some other kids that they targeted a little bit higher, and Michigan State basketball recruiting versus football is a lot different. But you know, there was always that question, well, how did Tom Izzo let him go from East Lansing to Ann Arbor? And I think that'd be the same case with Anthony as well.
I wrote a column on this with Anthony. Anthony's not in the same league as Randy Kinder, but Randy Kinder is probably the most heavily recruited guy out of here ever. But if you look at East Lansing itself, it's very different than the other schools around it. Like, or I went to high school, Lansing Sexton, huge pipeline to Michigan State. And that's where either they commit there and wind up there, or Kaiser Reynolds, Octavius Long, Howard Triplett, you know, a number of guys who've wound up, Dominic Brown have wound up there. You know, it's a place. If you grow up in Lansing, Michigan State, that's kind of a destination. That's pretty cool. If you grew up in East Lansing High School, you are literally on campus. You are frat houses within a stone's throw of your high school. And if you look at the numbers statistically, back to Mike Sullivan before Kinder and throughout the time, Brad Jones and all this stuff, they just don't – it's not like Michigan State loses kids in East Lansing. East Lansing kids want out, you know. And so they rarely get these kids, and they just want a different experience. When you're a senior in high school and you're on Michigan State's campus all the time, you know kids who are there, and you're just – I just think it's a hard thing to sell for when they've grown up on that campus literally. And so I don't think and I don't know what Anthony will do. I have no idea, and I have no idea what sort of impact he'll make right away. I do know Michigan State's got – good receivers with eligibility left in spades on the roster right now. So it's not like they're in immediate need at that position.
Yeah. And this was a big, the previous class that Mark D'Antonio had there. I mean, you're seeing a lot of those guys playing right away with Ricky White and Terry Lockett Jr. and Montori Foster, all have seen time early in this season as true freshmen with the talent that they still had coming back in Naylor and Reed and some of the other guys.
Okay, before we move on to the Michigan State-Iowa game and Mel Tucker and then preview Indiana, let's give a shout-out to our sponsor, Coors Light. These days, it seems life forces us to be on all the time, but every now and then, it's important to stop and reset. That's when you reach for a Coors Light. It's mountain cold refreshment made to chill. There's only one beer out there that's literally made to chill, and that's Coors Light. So make sure your refrigerator is stocked with Coors Light when the Spartans are playing or when you're watching any game. Coors Light is the official beer of watching any sport or any team. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's literally made to chill. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies, perfect for a moment to unwind. For me, the perfect moment is when the work is done and the game is on. So when life forces are go, 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 take a moment to chill with a Coors Light. Have it delivered straight to your door at get.coorslight.com. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado. Okay, so let's talk about the Michigan State-Iowa game. First off, number one, what the hell happened? And number two, I think it's, like you said at the top of the show, Mel Tucker is still clearly very fired up and very upset over what transpired on Saturday.
Yeah, well, he should be. They didn't look like a team that showed up, and they're not good enough not to show up. And Iowa, you know, Iowa, I think, had underperformed. And this game reminded me, and MSU fans have been around for a long time. Here's the comparison. I want to say it's 98 Michigan State Notre Dame. Michigan State's 0-2, underachieving, but they've got some dudes on the roster, and they're up, what, 43, 42, nothing at halftime against Notre Dame. It's one of those games where you're hungry, your season is on the line, you're home. This is it. If you don't win, it's pretty much over, and things snowball. And so it can happen. It doesn't say you're not capable, but there were things that happened to Michigan State, coupled with the fact that Michigan does not look anywhere near as good. I mean, they just keep looking worse week by week. That makes you see the deficiencies on Michigan State's defensive line in particular. So I think he has reason to be frustrated that they didn't show up. They didn't play with the same edge. But they also had some things working against them. Mostly the Minnesota game against Michigan and who Michigan actually is just continues to lie to people. And so you don't actually know what you're facing. Mel Tucker, when he's angry at his team, has no idea what happened in the Michigan game on Saturday. You know, what somebody probably needed to say to him is, hey dude, the team you beat last week absolutely sucks. And then you can go, oh, wait, I'm just kidding, obviously. But I think he had reason to be upset. They didn't execute. They didn't look as focused. They got rattled. They got blown over. But I also think he understands the reality. There's ways to go in building that roster.
Yeah, to me, the one surprise was the defensive line, particularly in the middle. I thought they got blown up a little bit after having two pretty good weeks of push and really having their way in the middle. I still think the edge pressure has and was going to be an issue all season. I mean, you lost Kenny Willekes, and there's only so many Kenny Willekes that'll come along, right? I mean, you can try and make Drew Beasley that next guy who's going to be from rags to riches, but you know, it's not that easy, right? I mean, you know, he's a guy that has, I don't think they've generated any pressure off the edge. You know, that's been a big problem. And the other thing is forcing turnovers. They have not been able to do that. I mean, you have two games in a row now without forcing a turnover, you can get away with it when you're not turning the ball over. When you're turning it over three times on offense, you have to be able to get some back. And, you know, they were around the ball carrier, but weren't really turning things over. The passing game, they were out of position. I think some of that had to do with moving guys in and moving guys around with Chris Jackson out. And then you slide Shakur Brown over to cornerback, and you've got Julian Barnett now coming in as a really young kid defensively, and that he didn't get a full camp, didn't get a full off season to make that transition from wide receiver to defense. And, you know, now you're putting him in the nickel spot. So, that's a work in progress, and that's going to be a work in progress, but you got to be able to get that pressure up front on the edge. And, you know, you saw more snaps from Michael Fletcher. And I think that was if there are a few positive developments that came out of that game, getting Michael Fletcher more reps is big, because I think he's the one guy, when you look at him, who can be that kind of dominant, significant pass rush force on the edge. He's got to work his way into it. And they need him, because, yeah, as much as Kenny Willekes did the past 2 years, I think one of the underrated things that he did was allow Jacob Panasiuk to be better. And now that Jacob Panasiuk has the pressure on him to be the guy, he's struggling a little bit.
Going off what you said a little bit ago about the work in progress, it seems like everything is a work in progress at this point, and it doesn't help the injuries. You know, of course, Antoine Simmons missed quite a bit of Saturday's game, and they seems like for the most part have been pretty cryptic about that. And it certainly appeared Rocky Lombardi, the quarterback, got injured at some point in the game. If he was not injured before, it was clearly affecting him. He was, you know, short arming and bouncing a lot of throws that he was not a week before against Michigan. I will note that when the few times they did go deep and hit fly routes or go routes or whatever you want to call them, they seem to be successful, and they didn't really go back to that only but a couple times Saturday.
Yeah, and you know, it's late, and I missed it actually in the quick takes or one of the things I was writing. There was a couple throws really late when I was writing furiously, and the game was already 49-7. But before it got to that point, they were 2-for-2 deep.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the old, you know, I mentioned this before, but it's the idea of, you know, if you're a great basketball player and you go 4-for-4 for 3 and your team loses by 20, you didn't do your job, because you got to shoot till you miss. If you're 4-for-4, why aren't you taking 12 threes, you know? And again, I understand Iowa takes that away, but there are certain things, there are very few things, I should say, that Michigan State appears to do well enough this year to impose on other teams. And the one thing they may have is that deep ball, and you've got to ride with that a little bit more when it's connecting like it is, and as dangerous as it is. And look, it was a game that got away from them quickly, but they should, to me, in the crux of the first, second, and early third quarters, there should have been a couple more at least.
Yeah, and you know, but you're right though. I mean, that quarter's defense that Iowa plays is meant to take that away, and you got to be able to hit the underneath throws to soften that up a little bit, which Lombardi was not able to do, but he also wasn't helped by the drops from his receivers.
Yep.
On some of those passes. So, I mean, his overall completion percentage looks even worse when those aren't there. And, you know, then you start wondering if let's talk about the decision-making as well. I mean, he had pressure in his face all day, and all three of his interceptions came under duress. One, he was flushed from the pocket and probably should have thrown the ball away, but instead tried to make a play downfield. And, you know, his receiver broke off the route again. I think it was Naylor. But he didn't throw it to a place where a defensive player couldn't get to. So you have that first one that ends up being like a punt. The second one, you know, that was the – I don't know if that was the pick six. I think it may have been – one of them, but he got hit and was under pressure on one of them. And then the pick six, he tried to step up in the pocket and slide and make a play. And that's when he fell down and threw the ball and right to the defensive player who was in between two of his receivers. So, I mean, the decision-making's got to be there. The receiver's got to make the plays. The blocking's got to be better. And, oh, by the way, why is that pressure so intense? Because you can't run the ball again. And it's, you know, Mark Antonio loved to talk about how everything was interconnected. And we saw that. And that was what you saw on Saturday. When things are completely disconnected all over, you're not going to have much success at all.
combining Saturday's press conference and Tuesday's press conference, at which position group or side of the ball did it seem like Tucker was the most upset about?
The one that was in front of it at that time.
Yeah. Because he was pretty vague. I think he was upset with a number of aspects to the game plan. And I mean, I don't think anything you saw was, I mean, he said it was hard for them to find somebody that did their job well. And
they switched punters in the middle of the game.
Yeah, right.
Outside of the 2018 season, where do you see that?
Yeah, to be fair, Behringer's punts, and I don't know if it was – wasn't there in Iowa City. It looked like they might have been wind-related, but Behringer was not very good, so I can understand why they would switch if you have somebody on that bench to do that.
The one he kicked from the end zone was an absolute line drive that went way past his coverage and then allowed the seams to develop. I mean, that was – you know, that you got to put some lift on it, and he didn't do that. And not only did the field position not flip, but he flipped it back for a touchdown. I mean, that was – not all on the punter either. I mean, the coverage team got blown away by Iowa's blocking on that. And, you know, that's – everything is so interconnected in football. I mean, it's probably more so than any other sport. And, you know, when you have one failure, you can maybe survive it. When you have 11 failures, you're not going to survive it at all.
That's funny because we gave Behringer a shout-out on the podcast last week too. And then we get the rare punter benching a week later.
Yeah.
So
that's the inconsistency that we're seeing. And that's, I mean, one of the things that Tucker said on Saturday that he said again on Tuesday is that consistency in performance is what they are seeking. And you have to have the consistency there. And again, this is where the frustration point comes in. You had everything going right and done to perfection against Michigan, and you regressed with mental errors and physical errors that fundamental errors. And that was the other thing that Tucker talked about after watching the tape, was the amount of fundamental errors that Michigan State had, and that's going to drive a coach nuts.
The thing that I found interesting, and the Atlanta St. Gerald's Nate Atkins wrote about this a little bit on Sunday, was the Michigan State really committed to their base defense and routinely found themselves outnumbered in the box, and they never really adjusted, and Iowa just seemed like it continued to take advantage of that. Was that your guys' impression on Saturday as well?
Yeah, I didn't think the backers played that well. It was weird because Antoine Simmons was in and out, and he wasn't healthy, so it was hard to evaluate those guys. And certainly they were in rough shape because the you know, they were getting to that next level so easy. I mean, they had a 70-yard run that was just a plain off-tackle run that just, you know, the line gets just – and, yeah, I mean, there are things about that defense that aren't ideal for facing the old Michigan State and the what Iowa, you know, wants to be, that sort of attack. But that – I don't know. I would like to see them with Simmons.
Yeah, I mean, you see how integral that he is. I mean, because with him there, that allows Noah Harvey to do the things that he can do well. But without him there, now you put in Chase Klein, and Harvey was kind of all over the place in terms of his performance. I didn't think he looked very good at all. Maybe he was trying to do too much. Maybe he was just thinking, I need to make every tackle, and getting pulled out of plays and, you know, fitting the wrong gaps and a lot of different things there. That really led to some of those bigger plays. That's the thing. They're thin at linebacker. You know, we talk about the offensive tackle being thin, but they're thin at linebacker too. I mean, essentially for first two games, you've mostly played Simmons and Harvey. Now you take Simmons out of there. You've got guys behind them that have not played a lot of football. There's the Chase Kleins. There's the Jesler Boateng's who didn't really get it. I mean, they've really, I don't know how they're going through playing a two linebacker scheme with only three linebackers that are active right now. That's a cause for concern.
Yeah.
But at the same point, what are you going to do? Are you going to go to a 4-3 when you only have two linebackers or three linebackers? That's not feasible either. So, you know, maybe there's a situation where you move a guy like Michael Dowell down to linebacker, I thought he played okay at the nickelback, rotating in with Angelo Gross and Barnett. And I think Angelo Gross is going to be a player to kind of keep an eye on here over the next few weeks. He's a stud in the making. And it's funny because someone mentioned him on Tuesday to Mel Tucker, and it was really, really subtle, but you could see the smile growing on his face when someone said the name Angelo Gross. So keep an eye on him coming on. And maybe getting some more reps soon, but at linebacker, you got to figure it out. I mean, you only have so many guys, and somebody's got to make some plays.
Yeah, Solari and I have been big Angelo Gross supporters since signing day, so he's another guy that the Spartan Speak podcast will back online and offline. I want to go back to Simmons for a second. Have you guys heard any whispers or insights into exactly what happened with him injury-wise?
I have not. I mean, you know, he was walking slowly on the sidelines. They have not really been forthcoming on that. He clearly wasn't right. That's all I know.
Yeah. If it happened during the game, it was early. If it happened before the game, during practice, that may have been also a situation there because, you know, after the game, Simmons talked about needing to play through it, and he was out there when he could. Now, there's the vagaries of it. I mean, there's always going to be the vagaries of the injury situation, particularly now when injuries plus COVID situations are popping up, and the staff and people around the program are even more tight-lipped to not blend the two. But Simmons certainly was not 100%, and he certainly was not effective when he was on there. So that was the other thing. Is now you're asking yourself, is a 50-60% Antoine Simmons better than 100% Chase Klein? And I think that was a question that they struggled with throughout that whole game. In all honesty, I mean, you ask a competitor, they're going to want to go out and play, but if they can't, I mean, you know, it has to be something significant for a guy like Simmons to take himself out and put himself back in and keep trying over and over again.
Okay, so I would say after this Iron game, this is probably the fourth time we have re-evaluated and re-evaluated Michigan State football season. We talked about it in the preseason. We changed things after Rutgers. Then we changed things again here on the podcast after Michigan. And now we're back to changing things again after Iowa. It just seems like it's really been a roller coaster of a season. So I ask you guys, I mean, what should the expectations and the goals for the team be at this point of the season? I mean, what's real? What's fake?
You know, I think what's real is they have some talent at wideout that they've maximized once they've got a quarterback who the jury is still out on, who is capable when he's got time, and we've seen that. I think he's a good leader. But as teams adjust to him, how he adjusts to them, I think that's still to be determined. I think it's a team that up front, when the matchup is something they can handle, will be okay on both sides of the ball. There will be games where it just doesn't look great. And I think we will see that again. And I think they're decent at linebacker. Obviously Simmons makes a big difference. I think they're better than we thought in the secondary. I do. I think, I thought that was going to be a really, really weak point for them this year. And that's not how Iowa beat them. So that's kind of where
To be fair, they haven't faced a quarterback yet. I mean,
they
will this week. They've played three first-year starting quarterbacks in Vedrill, in Milton, and then this week in Petras, and none of them had to beat them. Milton had to, but I thought Michigan State did a great job on that. But you know, that was, you know, that's going to be interesting this week because Indiana's got so many playmakers on the edge with Phil Yor and Hendershot and all those guys that they've got that can catch the ball, and Michael Penix Jr. We saw him last year in the fits that he gave Michigan State, which I'm still real. And I'd still love to pick Mike Tressel's brain about how much they prepared for Peyton Ramsey in that game, because Michigan State looked ill prepared, and I think they gave up 31 points in that game. And people forget how close that game was until Matt Coughlin's field goal with about 5 seconds left gave him the lead, and then they scored a touchdown on the ensuing kickoff after Indiana tried to throw it back and forth and Michael Dow recovered it. So these games have become very competitive against the Hoosiers, and I think that's what needs to be the goal. I mean, you can't set goals with this team for the rest of the season. It's literally got to be a week-to-week thing because this is a work in progress. And if Mel Tucker wants to talk about the process and progress in that process, you have to set short-term goals. You can't worry about the long-term goals. You got to be able to show that you can run the ball against Indiana's defense. You got to show that the Rocky Lombardi, who could hit on a high completion rate against Rutgers, can blend with the deep ball guy that you've seen the last 2 weeks to have a better stability at the quarterback position. But you know, this is going to be, you have to make sure, more importantly, that you are in the game, that you are competitive, that you are going to not all of a sudden give up four drives at the beginning of a game and three touchdowns. That can't happen. You can't have that happen three times in four games. You've got to show from the outset that your defense is willing to make stops, that your offense can move the ball and kind of build from there and really just go a possession at a time. And that's we talk about coach speak all we want, but that's ultimately where this team is when you don't have a spring practice, when you had maybe a month to prepare for the season, and now you're in season trying to make adjustments that with a bunch of guys that you're still learning about. I think you got to have very, very short-term goals.
Yeah. You know, outside of maybe Ohio State, it feels like Indiana is like the last team Michigan State should want to see right now with an exciting offense. They've looked good in beating Penn State and Michigan. And I just will be interested to see how everybody matches up. You know, I thought Petras for Iowa, I didn't think he played very well versus Northwestern in that game they lost. And then he turned things around and looked much better, looked much more confident versus Michigan State. So I don't know if that's just a maturation thing or if that's a situation where maybe Michigan State's defense, maybe we're asking questions about it.
You don't have to look too good when you're running for 230 yards a game as a team.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the big thing with Indiana is also going to, you know, they lost a game that they probably should have won last year, or at least their offense played well enough to win. They've had some heartbreak against MSU at times in recent years. Like, they won't look at MSU as a team that's, oh, they lost 49-7, and there's any chance that they overlook them. That's going to be – this is their moment, and I'm not saying MSU can't compete. I just – because Indiana doesn't overwhelm you physically entirely, but I think Michigan State's offense is going to have to put up some real points to be in this game.
Yeah, they scored 40 last year. Take away the late touchdown 30 some last year, and you're going to need to do at least that in this game because Indiana is significantly better than they were a year ago, and more importantly. And Tucker was asked about this, and I think he misinterpreted the question at first and went on a very, very long diatribe about belief in your own self and belief in your program. But that's what Indiana's doing right now. They believe they've won games that maybe they shouldn't have at Penn State. They've won games that historically they haven't against Michigan. So what success breeds is confidence, and Indiana's playing about as confident as anyone not named Ohio State in the Big Ten.
Indiana is one Ohio State COVID scare away from winning the Big Ten right now. I mean, this is their year.
Not a lie. Of course, that goes the other way as well. So
absolutely.
That's the roller coaster we're on right now.
So from your guys' perspective, what does, if you had some, maybe you haven't mentioned it or not, but what does Michigan State really need to do offensively to, you know, get those points that Graham mentioned to, you know, keep going with these guys and maybe pull one out at the end here with some luck?
Find some running room.
Yeah. We won't know that until, you know, because to me, you know right away, can they get the push they did against Michigan? Can their running game look like that? And can they protect the way they did there? If they do those things, they got a real chance. I think it all comes down to having a little bit of ability to run the football and get tough yards and then the ability to protect Lombardi. Because I think Lombardi is a pretty good quarterback when he has time, like a lot of quarterbacks are. But I think what we are seeing from him is that his level drops significantly under pressure. He's not somebody yet we have seen shake off pressure and make great throws. And so Michigan State has to know that too. And you've got to give him, you know, get him in spots where he's more and more comfortable to make the throws. But that I don't think we'll know it until we know how that offensive line holds up.
Yeah, I think that's the big key. I mean, that's ultimately where you need to get the points. And the receivers got to hold the ball as well. I think that's a big thing. I thought the running backs, for all the problems they've had in the run game, all five of them that they used had a catch. So they're using them out of the backfield to simulate a run game. So that's one thing. But at the same point, you still got to be able to get it up in between the tackles and, off tackle and have some sort of semblance of a run game. You don't have to have 230 yards like Iowa did. You got to have a competent 150 yards. So, you've got a chance to show that you can break into that second level a couple times to minimize the amount of pressure that they can throw at you up front.
If you had to guess, do you think we will see Peyton Thorne take any meaningful snaps on Saturday, or will it be the Rocky show the entire way?
Boy, that's a tough one to answer. I mean, he got his debut with the final possession in a 42-point blowout. So I think that they're hitching the wagon to Rocky Lombardi. Barring injury, I don't necessarily see that happening.
I don't think we don't see practice. Like, what we don't know is how close is Peyton Thorne to Lombardi in the coach's eyes, right? We have no idea. And I think at Iowa, it made sense. I understood, even though I would have gone to Thorne a little earlier just to give a different look, just to give a guy some more experience, I understood why they waited long. You're trying to walk that line between what feels like yanking a quarterback and what feels like just doing something in garbage time. And you don't want to yank Lombardi. But I do think this is an important game for Lombardi. I don't know that they would pull him in this game. But I think if this game went really, really poorly, and it looked like the last game, say, that would be interesting moving beyond that. And I don't know if it happens. I would guess that Lombardi plays the whole game unless it's a blowout. I do think this is an important game for him.
Well, it's an important game for him, but also for the whole team, because right now, let's look at the rest of Michigan State's schedule of how it shapes up here over the next few weeks. What is the winnable games? I mean, Maryland's playing significantly better, and they got to go there and face Talia Tungvalu and Tungvalu. Maryland is looking a lot better. I mean, maybe the most improved team from the beginning
it's
of the season.
Crazy what they've done the past 2 weeks.
You got to play Maryland. You still got to play Ohio State. I think I'm missing a game in there. But you also have to finish at Penn State, Penn State's winless right now. But, you still got to play at Penn State. So I don't know. I mean, this is why you have to focus on the short term, because if you start looking at that and you'll look at it like we're looking at it and say, boy, it's hard pressed to find one game the remainder of the season that you say Michigan State could go and win. That's where you got to have the competition and consistency and performance in this game. You have to be in it. You have to show that you can be in it. You have to show that 49-7 was a complete mirage. It doesn't matter win or lose in this performance. It has to be effort, and it has to be you have to make not get blown out. I mean, that the short and sweet of it is you can't get blown out again.
And the good news for MSU is if they don't win again in their scheduled games, they play Illinois in that ninth game. And
Northwestern, by the way, is the other one that I forgot. Northwestern 3-0.
And Northwestern's playing pretty well. They look pretty good. I do think they'll get a game somewhere, because I just don't think they have some things going for them in terms of, I believe there will be another matchup or two where they're physically up front able to hold their own. And if they have that, I think they have the playmakers to beat people. So I do think they'll win somewhere. I don't know what it'll look like. And the home road thing is interesting too, because, I haven't factored in the math from last week, but we really haven't. There's no advantage, to being on the road versus at home that's clear. And it looked like for a while, certainly there was a disadvantage to being home. I think teams will get over that. I think early in the season, it was jarring to come out to that. And that the more you play home without fans, it will be less of a detriment. But It's a weird year. So you just don't know. And you don't know where people's heads are going to be late in the season. You know, the thing about a team like Penn State that clearly didn't show up last week is, you know, late in the year when they don't have a chance to really play for anything in a COVID year, where are their heads going to be at the end? You know, if you're – and that the same could be said for Michigan State. You get a game where you just people just are checked out somewhere along the way. I don't think it'll be Maryland, though, because Maryland's found something. They're feeling pretty good about themselves. It ain't going to be Indiana. Northwestern, I think, you know, that's a couple weeks away still, isn't going to be them. And after that, now you're looking at the Ohio State and Penn State. So maybe a Penn State to end the year, but it's a tough road.
Yeah, and who knows where Penn State's minds will be if James Franklin's on the hot seat, too. That comes into play as well.
And Michigan State's had Penn State number in the past couple of years, if you think back to 2017 and 2018.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, Graham, you mentioned, I believe your phrase was, they're not going to beat Indiana this weekend, so we will move on to our official predictions for this weekend's game. Gentlemen, the spread is 7.5 in favor of Indiana. I believe it opened at 9. And if you want to have some fun with the over-under, it's 51.5. And if you want to make a prediction about that too, go ahead and tell us what you think is going to happen Saturday. Chris, go first.
Yeah, I think Indiana wins this game. But I think Michigan State keeps it in that two-score range. But it's going to be an over. I think there's going to be some points for both of these teams. I think it's going to end up being 40 to 29 or 40 to 30 range, somewhere in that.
Yeah, you know, it's hard for me to imagine Michigan State winning it. It's going to take me a while to fully trust Indiana, even though I was somebody who said they thought they might be the second best team in the East before the season. But I think this is going to, you don't get the home field you usually get. I think this is, I don't want to say it's not going to look like Iowa, but this will get away from Michigan State just a little bit. I think we're going to see something in the range of, 41-24, 38-24, and that range. I'll give MSU the benefit of the doubt and say, 38-24.
All right. So both of you guys have Indiana covering and hitting the over. So for those who want gambling advice from Chris and Graham, take them at their word.
Okay, hold on. One piece of gambling advice for them. If you want one, you want me to give you something. There's a play that's out there right now that people never take advantage of. A little complex, but if you're into the gambling world, you'll appreciate this. Look at the odds to win the Big Ten. Still great odds on Indiana, Northwestern, Purdue. And if you look at the standings, look, we all get that Ohio State's probably going to win it. But if you look at the rest of the teams Indiana has to play, all it takes is something to go wrong with Ohio State in a COVID year, and they're like plus 2,300. And if you look at the West and you pick the right team in the West, like Northwestern, which is also plus 2,300, and they get there, you just hedge the bet heavily the other way, and you win either way. So if you don't, are not into gambling, ignore that. But if you are, I'm telling you, there is some real potential with the Big Ten to be made.
Yeah, I primarily use DraftKings, so that's usually what I go off when I say these things. Northwestern is plus 1,400, Wisconsin plus 1,600, Indiana plus 2,000 to win the Big Ten.
Oh, that's interesting, because I saw Wisconsin plus 800 and Northwestern plus 23 somewhere today.
Oh, wow. So
Save your money. Don't bet Alabama LSU because it's off the board now. They will not be playing this week, so
they won't.
That's the fun thing is that everything's getting disrupted. So I would just pocket your money and save it for another year.
That's no fun.
I agree. That's no fun. All right. All right. Thank you for joining us for this edition of Spartan Speak, a production of the Lansing State Journal, Detroit Free Press, and the USA Today Network. If you enjoy this podcast and the work surrounding it, please consider subscribing. You can follow our coverage at lsj.com, freep.com, and on Twitter at Graham_Couch, at Chris Solari, at Phil_Friend, and at LSJ Greenwhite. Thanks for listening.